is the Victorian Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
G'day, Angus Furley here, filling in for Warwick Long on the Country Hour. Coming up, you'll get more detail on the Australia-UK Free Trade Agreement, with some big changes for sectors including wine, dairy and red meat. In the second half of the show, two farmers in the state's northeast have been fined a combined $160,000 over animal cruelty charges. And a bit of rain about in some parts overnight. How much did you get at your place? First up, though, a new ag visa will be offered to 10 Southeast Asian countries, and that's in an attempt to fill workforce shortages in Australian agriculture. The deal, it's been brokered alongside the UK Free Trade Agreement, which ends farm work requirements for British backpackers. The visa will be offered to ASEAN nations, including Indonesia, Myanmar, Vietnam, Singapore and the Philippines. Just a short time ago, Kath Sullivan asked the Agriculture Minister, David Littleproud, if he'd delivered an ag visa in part.
No, we've delivered it in full, and this is a big step in understanding the change in what COVID has done to our seasonal labour force. So this was a line in the sand that, as part of the UK Free Trade Agreement, I wasn't prepared to sign off on if they were going to give away UK workers not having to do their 88 days out in the bush. We had to have an ag visa to actually not only meet what was being lost out of the UK workers, but actually set in place a mechanism and a framework to move forward. And so this is a new ag visa that will supplement and complement the seasonal worker program and Pacific labour scheme.
Okay, last night we heard Boris Johnson and Scott Morrison say that the visa would be established for two-way exchange between the UK and Australia. Will you open it to other nations?
Yes. To the 10 ASEAN countries, then that's a very big and important step forward in making sure that we have a baseline in addition to our Pacific family. So this will be an important, and in many ways it will mirror that scheme. It'll be for 3 years and they'll have 6 to 9 months worth of work, must go back for the 3 months of the year, over the 3 year period each year. So this is in many ways...
So they need to return to their... home country.
Their origin, country of origin, exactly. So
For three months, every year.
At least 3 months every year, as they do with the PLS and SWP. So this is a great step, but it's formalised an ag visa that once we put in a baseline of these 10 Pacific nations, ASEAN countries, sorry, we can then look to add other countries into the future, but we really just want to start with our ASEAN family, who are strong, who are close, and are ready to work with us.
So we're talking about extending the seasonal worker program and Pacific labour scheme to those 10 ASEAN nations?
No, there'll be different conditions. While much of the program mirrors one another in terms of terms, there's more of the conditions, particularly with the PLS and SWP, there are greater requirements on those that bring them over around accommodation and looking after those people, whereas this new ag visa will have more of the working holiday maker conditions around people management rather than the SWP and PLS.
Okay, so what kinds of people are you hoping to attract to this scheme?
Well, anyone across those 10 ASEAN countries.
Do they have to have farm experience?
Well, no, we'll let the market work that out. I know there's enterprising labour hire companies out there that will be working with this. And I have to also stress those countries will have to opt in. It's not just because Australia stands up and we say we're going to provide this visa that they'll come. So we'll be working through high commissions and embassies to make sure in those 10 ASEAN countries they know what their citizens can come and do and what are the conditions and what they can expect, and obviously hope that they would obviously sign up to it.
Is this just a COVID measure, or is there an end date?
No, this is lock, stock and barrel. It'll be reviewed in 5 years, obviously, like every visa.
And how many workers do you expect?
Well, it has to be more than 10,000, and obviously we're opening up to make sure that we not just bring and make up the 10,000 that we could be losing from the UK, but building greater capacity, because this is the challenge we've seen. Of the 25,000 in the PLS and SWP that are sitting in the Pacific at the moment, the states have only brought in about 7,000. So we need to give greater options to our farmers to be able to not just look to the Pacific, but look to our ASEAN countries as well to bring in workers.
Okay, and we've seen the UK basically say we don't want our backpackers to have to work on Australian farms. Are you concerned that working holiday makers from other countries might say the same things to their government?
No, well, they're out of luck. We decide who comes to this country.
So it's only the UK is exempt.
The UK
from
and New Zealand are the only two countries that have that exemption, and that's because of our historical ties. The rest are out of luck. They'll come to this country on the conditions and the circumstances which we allow them to. We are giving them an opportunity in those ASEAN countries in the Pacific to come across and to be part of our agricultural workforce and make good money and take it back to their communities and to their families. That's a significant investment in them, but as far as we're concerned, those conditions around the 88 days being taken away will only relate to UK and New Zealand citizens.
And when do you expect the first workers on this visa will hit the ground?
I have an undertaking from the Prime Minister. It was a condition of my support and the National Party support of this agreement to have it up and going before the end of the year.
So the Nats would walk from the coalition if you couldn't get this visa?
I don't think that it'll come to that. We have a strong commitment from the Prime Minister. We made it clear when I negotiated this that obviously we were very excited about the increase in quotas, but this was a line that we couldn't cross if we were to try and trade away seasonal workers at a time of shortage. It just didn't make sense. And with all due respect, the Prime Minister himself had made a commitment to the NFF at their National Congress in 2019 that said that we would work towards an ag visa. So we are living up to our commitment and we've finally got there. I would have liked it a lot quicker, and obviously I've been pushing for this pretty hard, and I'm pretty chuffed we've got there.
How difficult was it to get your Liberal partners over the line on this?
Once they saw my point of view and the National Party's point of view, it was common sense.
Agriculture Minister David Littleproud speaking there with Cath Sullivan. Well, we do stay now on that new ag visa. Bill Bulmer is chairman of industry peak body AusVeg, also a vegetable grower at Lindenau in East Gippsland. He says it will take time to find the right workers for the work that needs to be done in Australia.
Well, under the Pacific Island scheme and the seasonal worker program, we have a range of different types and size of workers that suit different categories. It's no point getting a 6'4" Tongan try to bend down to pick something maybe that's 4 inches off the ground. So there are people in certain countries that are more adaptable and more flexible than certainly most Australians and some of the bigger islanders for different roles. So, it's a fit for purpose. So we welcome opening up those 10 Southeast Asian countries because it gives us flexibility to source workers for different regions for different jobs.
The labour shortage is happening right now and has been happening for a long time, but it's going to take a while, isn't it, to develop this program and develop those relationships?
It is going to take a fair bit of time. I just mentioned the seasonal worker program, the Pacific Island scheme. We want to make sure that those two programs keep progressing, and we know the constraints under the COVID restrictions of bringing people into the country at the moment is going to be very difficult. But moving forward, we know not only in agriculture and horticulture, but right across most sectors that employ seasonal labour, there is a massive shortage. We did have 160,000 people in that category of backpackers and temporary visa holders. Now we're down to about 30,000 people. So it's not only horticulture that's missing out, it's a range of other industries as well.
What's been the situation on your farm in terms of the worker shortage?
Well, we're into the winter period, so it's slowed down, so we've got our stable workforce here and in the East Gippsland region, especially in the Lindenau area where there's four or five major players that are 24/7 operators. We've got through the summer, but the valley was probably down about 20% of workers, but we did manage to scrape through. But next year, with the amount of workers that have gone back home, there's definitely going to be a shortage right across our region as well as the country.
And I suppose the other thing is that this ag visa program is meant to be up and running before the end of the year, according to David Littleproud. But if COVID issues are still in place, then quarantine issues will have to be managed, won't they?
That's been an issue all the way through. No disrespect to David, bureaucracy moves fairly slowly at the best of times. And with COVID, it's going to be a real challenge. So the quarantining process need to make sure that the Commonwealth government, along with the states, are in alignment with what quarantine processes can be put in place to alleviate these short-term problems within the regions.
And to this point, how has that worked with the state government managing quarantine for those workers from the Pacific Islands?
The states, in all fairness, have never played in the space of seasonal worker programs. It's been a Commonwealth-based program. So there was a fair bit of finger-pointing on the early days. Not being backward, the state government of Victoria being a bit slow in what they did, but they did get it enacted. But by the time we brought those seasonal workers in and quarantined them into Tasmania, most of the seasonal work was nearly finished in Victoria. But speaking to Marianne Thomas, I pleaded with her to make sure that the program keeps going, because come springtime, August, September, when the southern states start to ramp up for looking for workers, we'll need those workers to be here in Australia. We can't wait for them to come in and be quarantined.
Just finally, Bill, labour has been an issue for a long time in agriculture, and particularly in horticulture. Do you think we'll look back on this announcement as maybe a bit of a turning point when that issue of finding labour started to be resolved?
I hope so. You know, in all fairness, we don't need to force backpackers to come and work on farms to gain extra 12 months on their visas. We need competent, reliable workforce. It does help in certain regions where there is a very short season, but the long-term vision of Australian horticulture is we need a competent and, I said, a reliable workforce that is educated in the skills that we need within horticulture to maintain supply of product across the country.
That was Bill Woolmer, chairman of AusVeg and a vegetable grower in East Gippsland. Staying on that ag visa program still, it's something that the Victorian Farmers Federation has wanted for a long time now, several years. I spoke with President Emma Germano about how she thinks it will work.
I really hope we go well sourcing workers from those countries, because we know that there are just dire workforce shortages across agriculture. And even if workers from those particular places aren't fit for purpose for all the different ag sectors, you know, just getting more workers into the pool will be very, very helpful, particularly for horticulture. Those nations would be very useful if indeed we can actually get workers into the country, because, of course, there's one thing having a visa pathway. We also then need a quarantine pathway as well. So looking forward to hearing more about that particular announcement and some details around it, whether there's caps or quotas attached to it, you know, what are the requirements, are there going to be any English language speaking requirements, which, you know, there's been some calls from industry to ensure that we don't end up with a workforce that could potentially be exploited. So, you know, what will be the onus on employers to actually be able to access the ag visa? All of those details, there's been no meat on the bones, but the basics of it's an ag visa, it's from some of these nations at the moment, that sounds very promising.
So, Emma, as you said, the free trade agreement essentially means we'll probably be losing 10,000 UK backpackers who would be working on farms. The trade-off is the introduction of the ag visa for the ASEAN nations. Will the industry here be able to source 10,000 or more workers from those ASEAN nations to fill that void?
Again, we're going to have to see, you know, how the adoption goes, and you know, just opening the visa doesn't mean that people start coming in droves either. That it often takes quite a bit of time for the traction to start in countries overseas where people understand that that's available to them before they actually start jumping on it. You know, we're certainly not out of the woods yet when it comes to the fact that we've been just bleeding productivity, not having enough workers. I mean, people can't get their cows milked. People can't get their sheep shorn. People can't find header drivers. You can't get your fruit and veggies picked. It has been really, really difficult. And, yeah, we need to increase that productivity. We're not just talking about the immediate shortages that we face because of the pandemic. We already had workforce shortages before the pandemic. And we're an industry that's trying to grow as well. We've got big aspirational targets for growth. You need more workers if you want to hit those growth targets. And we didn't have enough already. So long said that it's, you know, a diversified workforce that's a strong workforce. So we need to make sure that, you know, the ag visa works in harmony with the seasonal worker program, the Pacific Labour Scheme. We need to continue to incentivise Australians onto the farms. There's just not enough workers out there. And it's not even just an ag issue. We know that we were really fighting and competing with the tourism sector when it came to some of those European backpackers who particularly like working in hospitality. So this is good news for agriculture, but it's also good news for other industries that will have less competition, I suppose, from ag if we actually get meaningful numbers in on that ag visa.
At this stage, this new ag visa is restricted to those 10 ASEAN nations. Any reason why it shouldn't be opened up to other countries?
Probably not from an Emma Germano perspective here in Australia, but I'm sure they're you know, we're talking about international relations, and there's a whole bunch of complications that, you know, as ordinary citizens, we're not always aware of, and there's trade-offs that are made. We know that the federal government was very dedicated to the Pacific scheme because it was about national security also. It's about ensuring that we've got strong ties to the Pacific and we don't see other nations going into the Pacific and potentially creating military bases and things like that. So there's a lot more to it than just the free movement of people, of course. So I guess we've been very patient, but we have said that, you know, we can be as understanding as we like, but, you know, we can't let agriculture, you know, just bleed from that lack of productivity.
The Victorian Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
The red meat industry appears to be one of the winners. Quotas will be lifted to 175,000 tonnes for beef and 125,000 tonnes for sheep across a 15-year period. To contrast those figures with some of the current exports to the UK, I spoke with Patrick Hutchinson, Chief Executive of the Australian Meat Industry Council.
Look, Angus, it's pretty small. It's actually underpinned by a quota or quota structure, and obviously pre-Brexit it was a total EU quota. So on grass-fed, what's called HQB quota, it's about 7,500 to 8,000 tonnes, and for sheep it's about just under 20,000 tonnes. So the changes that have been announced overnight, obviously, and the work that we've undertaken have obviously resulted in something far in excess of that.
Right, so that current trade is nothing to speak of, really, is it?
It's quite small. It's in the hands of a few people, and it's very high value, but very small volume.
Now, run me through what changes with these announcements included in the free trade agreement.
Yeah, look, very simply, what's occurred now is that there's a duty-free quota for beef at starting at 35,000 tonnes when it comes into force, this agreement, and it rises every year over a 10-year period, finishing at 110,000 tonnes in year 10. And for sheep, it's 25,000 tonnes and rises in equal instalments to 75,000 tonnes by year 10. After that time, both of those I would say is that it's a first-come, first-served structure. So a safeguard then gets put in place. So those thresholds keep rising in equal instalments to 175,000 tonnes. And if we go over that in a 15-year period, then we would have a safeguard of 20% for the rest of the calendar year. And that's the same as how it works in China. And the same thing for sheep, but it's 125,000 tonnes at the end of that 15th year, and there's a safeguard of 20% that sits on that.
So, Patrick, I guess in some senses those upper limits are somewhat irrelevant if they can't be reached. So what's it going to take to grow exports to the UK, and will exporters be able to readily grow those figures?
Look, we believe so. Obviously, we're in the depths of one of the more, I guess, heavily corrected cycles of livestock supply that we've seen in recent memory, in fact, probably almost in history, coupled with the obvious issue that we face at the moment with a lack of workforce due to an inability to attract domestic workers, and two, to obviously get access to international workers. So I think that because this is going to be 12 months before it does come into force, it does give us time to work and get prepared. But that being said, it's what Australia does best, better than anyone else in the world, and that is that creating a structure for a reliable supply chain of red meat internationally that will allow us an opportunity to and using the 2020 word of the year, pivot. So we have an opportunity to be able to go and access different markets to achieve the best total carcass value that we can, which rewards farmers, but also ensures that we underpin the processing facilities that support every farmer in this country. And I think we can't lose sight of that, that those guys need to attract better margin in order to remain solvent and moving forward.
That was Patrick Hutchinson, Chief Executive of the Australian Meat Industry Council. And what do you think that's going to mean, those quite substantial increases to quotas for beef and sheep into the UK? Also, that earlier story that we had before we crossed to the COVID press conference on the announcement from the federal government that it's going to create an ag visa. something the VFF, among others, has wanted for a long time now. 10 Southeast Asian countries, people in those countries will soon be able to access visas to come and work on Australian farms. You can text in 0467 842 722.
The Victorian Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
Staying on that free trade agreement, lots of different industries have been affected. The dairy industry is one of those, and it will have tariffs removed over a five-year period. Exporters will get immediate access to a duty-free quota of 24,000 tonnes of cheese, and that will rise to 48,000 tonnes after 5 years. There will also be immediate access for 20,000 tonnes of non-cheese dairy products. Noel Campbell, a dairy farmer in West Gippsland and former president of Australian Dairy Farmers, says it's good news, although most dairy farmers shouldn't expect any increase to the price that they're paid for their milk.
It's always positive to have these trade agreements. I think this particular one might take some time to get some significant advantages, but there might be some ability to get some niche type products into the UK, which we haven't had over a long period of time. You know, it's back in the 1970s when we first got dumped off in New Zealand with respect to them going into the EU.
So some of the figures, Noel, in 5 years' time, up to 48,000 tonnes of cheese and immediate access to 20,000 tonnes of non-cheese dairy products. Are those figures substantial?
I guess from a total industry point of view, they're not, but they may be sort of boutique-type products, which could mean that they've got a greater value. So it would definitely add up to it.
Obviously, there's the tyranny of distance question. Is it going to be feasible, viable to be exporting dairy to the UK?
I guess if we go into our supermarkets, we see plenty of European cheese products on our shelves, so hopefully it's the same as us putting our product into their shelves.
And the discussion around the free trade agreement to this point has been very much a big picture sort of discussion, but all the individual dairy farmers really care about is what it means for them. So what is it going to mean in terms of the price offered here to Australian dairy farmers?
I don't think farmers will see a substantial difference in their price. Obviously, at the moment, we're in some good times with respect to milk prices, but I don't think we'll see... you would be able to see the upside in your price very much. But it's all good for the long term.
So, yeah, all good, but if it doesn't translate back to the price in any sort of meaningful way, how important is it?
Well, different processes will supply that market. It might not be the mainstream processes, or it might be more boutique-type processes that are in Australia that actually benefit from this sort of thing. It might not be mainstream cheddar-type products that a lot of our processes are good at. But boutique-type processes, smaller processes that may only have, you know, up to 30 or 40 suppliers, they may get some significant benefit, but I can't see the mainstream getting much at this point in time.
Okay, so maybe not industry-wide benefit, but benefit in specific niche areas.
Quite likely, I would say, yeah.
Just before I let you go, Noel, the other aspect of this is the creation of an ag visa scheme for Southeast Asian countries. What's that going to mean for the dairy industry?
Labour is one of the biggest issues dairy's got. We use quite a lot of backpackers. Increasingly, we're doing that, so any benefit that we can get there will be a big advantage as well. So hopefully this visa scenario will bring better ability for us to get labour.
And do you think creating those ag visas for those 10 Southeast Asian countries, is that going to see people from Southeast Asia coming and working here on dairy farms in Australia?
I'd like to think so. I think New Zealand has had quite a few Asian visa holders that work for them. Seasonal workers would be good as well for dairy, like if you had the ability to bring someone from somewhere like an East Timor, the same person every year for 3 or 4 months. It would be great to have that same person come onto your farm, know the farm, etc., and be there and be hands-on straight away. As I said, labour's one of our biggest issues on our farms, and we need to deal with that.
That was West Gippsland dairy farmer Noel Campbell. Well, we'll hear shortly about two brothers from the northeast of the state. They've been fined $160,000 for over animal cruelty charges. But before that, it's time for the Weather Bureau now. Senior forecaster Chris Avia is on duty. Good afternoon, Chris.
Afternoon. How are you going?
Oh, well, not too bad, Chris, because I'm sitting here in the studio in Horsham listening to some pretty decent rain.
Yeah, look, it's been pretty good for the west and northwest of the state. Overnight, we had around 10 to 15 millimetres over a lot of the west and pushed into central areas first thing this morning as well. Highest was 25 at Mount William and the Grampians. But, yeah, pretty widespread falls of 10 to 15. So very decent drop for places that were pretty parched through a lot of autumn. So good to see that. And rain continuing during the afternoon through there as well. So we're likely to see a few more showers, particularly about the Wimmera District, as we get into the afternoon today. A lot of falls elsewhere in the state, looking at around probably around the 1 to 5 millimetre mark for much of the north during this afternoon, and a little bit of that pushing to the southwest as well. Mostly dry now across Gippsland and the rest of the south. So, yeah, handy drop for today, and then heading into tomorrow as well. We'll see a few more showers about the north of the state. I've got a fairly messy trough low pressure system that's passing to the south at the moment, so fairly cloudy conditions tomorrow, relatively cool, and some light showers for a lot of the state, but nothing of huge significance, around 1 to 5 millimetres. One to watch though for tomorrow will be the chance of some afternoon storms out your way in the west, and that might enhance a bit of rainfall, but they'll be quite isolated though, so if you are under a storm you might get an isolated drop of around 10 millimetres or so, but generally speaking we're looking at around that 1 to 5 millimetre mark for tomorrow for the west and north.
Chris, we certainly for the entire season really in most of the northwest of the state we haven't had one proper fall, but we just seem to keep getting these 5, 10, 15 millimetre falls.
Yeah, it'll help top up things a bit, I guess. We're still well below average for the year, if you look at the year so far. And if it wasn't for quite a wet January, we'd be on one of our, you know, sort of lowest on record type of things. But it was actually quite a wet January has boosted the stats a little bit for Western Victoria. But it's certainly been incredibly dry. I believe at Mildura we went something like over 4 months and there's only around five millimetres or so of rain. And we haven't had a few drops since then, which has helped, I guess, at least wet the ground a little bit, but probably most folks are hoping for a bit more. So, yeah, look, a little bit more on the way at the moment. But in terms of the rainfall, places that probably don't want it is Gippsland, which is where we obviously saw the very heavy falls last week and the flooding. And on Friday, it does look like we'll see further rain in Gippsland, particularly the far east, as another low develops off the east Gippsland coast. So likely to see a bit of rain about all of southern Victoria on Friday, increasing during the afternoon is the main time, but the heaviest falls will be through East Gippsland. We're looking at widespread falls of 25 to 40 millimetres out that way. So East Gippsland didn't feel the brunt of that heavy rain last week. So at this stage, it looks like we could see a bit of minor flooding associated with these falls, but it doesn't look like nearly the magnitudes that we saw last week resulting in that major flooding. And then for West and South Gippsland, which was the hardest hit last week, probably more in the 5 to 15 millimetre range on Friday. So, look, it's probably not good news for Gippsland that there is more rain coming their way, and there is the potential for some minor river rises associated with that system on Friday and continues on Saturday morning before it moves away. So a bit of rain on the way for the south, particularly Gippsland on Friday and Saturday.
So hoping it doesn't fall in those places that really copped it last week. But I guess the forecast for the rest of the state for the rest of the weekend and into next week, Chris?
Yeah, look, really looking like we're going to get a few nice days for the state. But on the weekend, showers continuing in Gippsland during the morning, but it really starts to drop off by the afternoon. It's going to be a cloudy day in the south, but nice and sunny in the north. And then by Sunday, we're basically sunny statewide with fairly mild, cool to mild conditions, not getting much above 14 degrees for most locations. But, yeah, a nice sunny day on Sunday. We're under a high-pressure ridge by Sunday, and that's going to hang around for a few days. So Sunday, Monday, Tuesday are all looking like we're going to have a nice little spell of fine winter weather for those 3 days. So dry across the state, fairly sunny. Chances of morning frost, though, for inland parts. So we could be getting down, particularly Monday morning, down to sort of ones or zeros or minus ones inland. So we do have a chance of seeing some reasonably extensive frost inland on Monday morning. But a run of pretty dry days during that part of the week. And then a brief sneak peek at the middle to end of next week. looks like our next chance of seeing some rainfall across the state as the next low that's building in the Bight starts to approach us towards the end of next week. So that's sort of one to keep an eye on. But yeah, until we get there, it's relatively benign falls aside from East Gippsland on Friday.
Okay, thanks, Chris.
Cheers.
Chris Arvey there, Senior Forecaster at the Weather Bureau, forecasting a bit of rain, and a couple of rainfall figures have come through on the text line as well. A texter at Skipton has recorded 9 millimetres, and Ryan Milgate, farmer east of Minyip, he's only had 3 millimetres, certainly hoping there's more on the way. You can text in 0467 842 722.
On ABC Radio Victoria, this is the Victorian Country Hour.
Two Victorian livestock producers have been fined a total of $160,000 after pleading guilty to numerous animal cruelty charges. The brothers from Balmaddin were convicted of animal cruelty that led to the death and serious disablement of cattle in 2018 and 2019. Agriculture Victoria compliance manager Daniel Bode told Eden Henninen that despite the obvious suffering to the animals, cases like this jeopardise Victoria's reputation as a responsible producer of food.
This was a case involving two accused, both brothers Anthony and David Maher from Balmaddin. Over two distinct periods in 2018 and 19, the accused were in charge of a large number of cattle and sheep, and despite numerous attendances from our officers, including notices to comply, we observed the persistence of intolerable conditions for the livestock, and that resulted in us having to take significant action in relation to the condition of those animals, including having to euthanise a number of cattle.
How many animals were harmed?
There was a large number of animals over the property in the thousands. The charges related to herd charges, but also a number of individual animals as well. Throughout the period of offending, it wasn't just a one-off period. There were livestock were not being provided with the appropriate food, weren't being provided with adequate supervision or veterinary treatment or safe access to water. And as a result, we had no alternative but to intervene, and that included the euthanasia. But it wasn't a one-off. There were notice to comply issued where there was non-compliance, and that, as a result, that's why a brief of evidence was put forward before the courts.
Was this a relatively large case for Agriculture Victoria?
It was significant in the size of the property, the size of the number of animals. It required a significant amount of resources. But any time we're dealing with these sort of cases, the department will always ensure that we're providing every resource we can to firstly deal with the issues before us regarding the animals' welfare, and then also look at it from an investigative standpoint, so that our committee, those offences can be held to account.
So the brothers have been charged. Will they be able to run their own livestock in future?
Yeah, well, they've received at this time a disqualification order for being in charge of any farm animal for a period of 10 years. Because they're currently in custody of some animals, there is a stay period to allow arrangements to be made for those animals. But as of January of next year, the accused will be disqualified from owning or being the person in charge of any farm animal as defined under the Provincial Cruelty Animals Act. For 10 years is the maximum period that can be imposed at this time.
So have you seen many cases like this?
We're seeing more. We've had a number of cases where banning orders have been, or disqualification orders have been imposed, some conditional, some complete orders such as this. And it's always based upon the court's perception or the understanding of the level of offending, but also the fact that it was continuous. And it's all about the strength of a disqualification order that prevents this sort of cruelty from occurring in the future. So I think the importance of animal welfare sets us up to be valued in the community. It is important that all people are treating animals as appropriately, avoiding any unnecessary pain and suffering. And these sort of cases are important to bring to the knowledge not only of the individuals but of the community, that both the Victorian community and the Victorian government will not tolerate animal cruelty.
Agriculture Victoria compliance manager Daniel Bode speaking there with Eden Henninen. Well, today marks 7 days without power for dairy farmer Peter Young, who's based at Buffalo in South Gippsland. It's been a frustrating week for Peter, who, like many others, has had to deal with periods of no telecommunications at the same time as the power outage. I spoke with him earlier.
Yeah, well, the power went off here around 6 p.m. on Wednesday. Luckily, I've got a generator installed in the cow shed, so I've been able to milk and chill the milk, plus run water pumps and everything. But there for a 12-hour stretch, we had no mobile access, no internet access, and no landline, which was a major concern, not just for us, but anyone in the region. If we needed emergency services, we were stuck.
So you've ticked into your seventh day of no power and relying on the generator.
Yeah. With that generator, it's big enough so I can do most things, but there's no hot water, so I've got to sort of heat the water down the shed, and there's definitely no hot water in the house. But, it's just something I've got to... I run the tractor probably 14 hours a day, so it's using a lot of diesel, and it's something I've got to get up to do every morning before I can get any other jobs done.
Power outages in some areas can be, unfortunately, a part of life, but have you ever gone this long without power?
The longest I can remember is a day and a half. But in the old days, when I was a kid, we had crews in every town just about, so something went down, they were onto it fast, whereas now they're relying on contractors. Like, the blokes are doing a bloody good job. We're not going to knock them, but it's just such a big area and so much work to be done, they just can't keep up. Plus, they don't clear the trees as far away from the poles as they used to. They clear the branches away. But as this last storm proves, like, there's too many trees close to power lines. So when the wind blew, it just destroyed it.
And on that point, do you know what actually caused the outage, and do you know what the hold-up is in getting it fixed?
Oh, they can't tell me. I think they've only just started looking at our line. Like, they were so busy trying to get the major towns up, and we're one of the sort of more tail-end lines that they haven't even had time to look at it yet. So... they were telling us that the power was going to come on at 11:30 p.m. on the 13th, and they were still telling us that at 11:30 on the 14th.
Not holding your breath, I imagine.
No, well, we've now got a helicopter flying over low, so I think he's probably checking the line, but it's probably the first time they've been able to actually get around to our line to have a look at it. But there's just so much damage down, I just think they're just overloaded.
Have you got neighbours in the same position?
Yes, yeah, all my neighbours are in the same position. We've all sort of been checking on one another, especially when the phone lines that were out. But, we're all just sort of waiting it out. A few of us have got generators, so been able to keep the fridges and freezers going. Some people have lost everything in their freezers because they just didn't have the power to do anything about it. But, this is just getting on the joke. A couple of days, 3 days, but once you get to seven, it's like, ridiculous.
I imagine you've gone through quite a bit of fuel running the generator for so long.
Yeah, probably 200 litres a day. So you can count that up pretty fast. The tractor, you got to run a 100 horsepower tractor to run that generator. It's running probably 14 hours a day. So, yeah, you're going through a lot of fuel.
And how about the cows, Peter? Is it sort of business as usual for them, or does it mean changes to the routine?
I've had to bring them back to the dairy side of the road because I had no power at all over the road, so therefore they just went through fences and all over the place. So I've had to change my rotation that way a bit. Yeah, other than that, not a lot because on this side of the road I can still run my stock water because it's all hooked up to the shed, so the fences work except when I've got to turn the generator off, but they've sort of got used to that and... They've got plenty of stock water and the milkings are pretty well run as usual.
So where to from here? Just keep fueling the tractor and waiting for the power to come on, I suppose?
Pretty much. There's not really much I can do about it. I know two of my local representatives, Denny O'Brien and Melina Barth, have been trying to chase things up for me and the UDVs on it to try and hurry things up. But there's really not a lot they can do. Like, it's what they've got to do once things are back up, and that's get some more backup systems going.
Peter Young, a dairy farmer at Buffalo in South Gippsland. And how frustrating, 7 days without power. Still not sure when it's going to come back.
The Victorian Country Hour on ABC Radio Victoria.
You may have noticed the price of avocados has dropped pretty sharply recently, with consumers cashing in on big surges in the volumes of fruit that's being grown this year. So what impact is the huge supply and low prices having on growers? Ashley Bagshaw reports.
Avocado lovers are benefiting from a huge drop in prices at the moment, with current costs as low as $1 per avocado. But on the flip side of the coin, the increase in supply is creating a tough market for growers. Tim Keogh, owner of Triple M Mangoes and Avocados in Capra in central Queensland, says that growers are having to adapt to a tightly packed market.
Overall, I think this is probably more like the new norm. This was certainly coming. It's been coming for a long time. All those trees that were planted 5 or 6 years ago and earlier, you know, are all coming into production now. It's putting pressure on that domestic market for sure. This season, we've probably had the biggest crop we've ever had within our trees. So, and I'm sure that's, you know, right across the board. So everyone's having a big season, and plus all those younger trees coming on board is where we're at today.
So is it fair to say the market's starting to look a little overcrowded?
I think it is right at the moment, absolutely. We all knew it was coming. It's just a matter of trying to hold that fair price and keep the fruit flowing through the market. And also, in terms of export, you know, there is avocados, I believe, getting exported, but, you know, whether that's enough at the moment, I'm not too sure. I'd say there isn't, not having enough planes in the sky and freight being so expensive at the moment, it certainly plays a part.
Prices are incredibly low at the moment, which is good for consumers, but not so much for the growers.
Well, that's right. It is good for the consumers. And as I say, this was always coming. And it's probably time for the consumer to get on board and multi-buy and while they're cheap and make the most of it.
Is this something that you think might be ongoing, or is this just a current problem?
I think it's going to be challenging in years to come with the larger supply coming through, and that's going to increase as the years go on. So I think we just need to concentrate more on some marketing strategies and perhaps exporting some more as our supply increases over the years. You know, our consumption, I believe, is still going up, and I think consumption still around the world is increasing.
That was Tim Keogh, a mango and avocado grower from Cabra in central Queensland. Avocados Australia CEO John Tyas says we're seeing record volumes of the fruit being harvested this year.
We've been increasing pretty steadily for a number of years, probably about 6 or 7% a year. This year, our increase compared with last year, we're going to be up 65% of our current forecast, so 65% more Australian avocados harvested this year compared with last year. So that's a really big jump in a fairly short period of time.
What does the surge in supply mean for growers?
Yeah, a lot of growers are doing it pretty tough at the moment. You know, the prices have come back. They're very marginal. Hopefully, you know, we can see the cauldrons clearing and we can continue to try and build demand. The upside, if there is any, is that it's an opportunity to try and get a lot of new consumers into the category, getting people to use avocados in more different dishes and really capitalising on the opportunity of really good value avocados. The other opportunity is in terms of our export markets, with the prices where they are at the moment, makes us very competitive on a price basis.
Avocados Australia Chief Executive John Tyas sending that report from Ashley Bagshaw. That does, of course, mean we're off to the markets now, starting today at Leongatha Cattle with Brendan Fletcher.
There were 70 fewer at 1430, with the usual buyers present but not all operating fully in a mixed market. Quality was wintry, with finish lacking throughout. Trade cattle sold around 10 cents dearer. Grown steers and bullocks lifted 5 to 10. Better finished manufacturing steers gained 10 to 15 cents. Cows eased 5 to 10 cents, with processors loading cows for an estimated 542 to 658 cents a kilogram carcass weight. Heavy bulls sold firm. Grown steers 410 to 439. Bullocks 412 to 429. Heavy Friesian steers 305 to 359, crossbreds 312 to 420. Most light and medium weight cows 215 to 260, heavyweights 245 to 344, heavy bulls 285 to 320. This is Brendan Fletcher reporting for MLA.
Thanks, Brendan, to Warrnambool Cattle now with Eric Australian.
783 mixed quality cattle at Warrnambool, 296 more. Prices for better bred young cattle were mainly equal, with some sales slightly easier, but plainer and dairy bred yearlings sold on a dearer trend. Grown steers remained unchanged, but Friesians were 5 to 6 cents higher. Beef cows eased 5 to 10 cents, but the heifer types came back 10 to 15, and restockers paid a lot less than last week's extreme levels. The rest of the cows averaged 15 cents lower. A handful of yearlings to processors made 378 to 420 cents, Most going to feed on at $3.90 to $4.40. Grown steers made $3.70 to $3.84. Lighter weights from $4.16 to $4.20, and restockers paid to $4.46. The Friesian steers were from $3.25 to $3.38 a kilogram. Beef cows were mostly between $3.23 and $3.56. The better covered dairy cows were from $2.62 to $2.90. It's been Eric Australian reporting for MLA.
Thanks, Eric, to Wodonga Cattle now with Leanne Dax.
Good afternoon. 360 cows and 17 bulls sold to most of the usual buying group. Quality was fair to good, with very few leaner types on offer. The market was very solid for heavy cows, with prices firm to 5 cents easier, $3.16 to $3.45. The middle run were limited and distorted price trends. The very few that were on offer sold at $2.72 to $3.13. Dairy cows, $2.06 to $2.74. And bulls sold to dear trends of 4 to 5 cents, $3.10 to $3.76. I'm Leanne Dax for MLA.
Thanks, Leanne. Hamilton Lambs now with Chris Agnew.
Agents yarded 8,687 lambs and 3,960 sheep at Hamilton this week. There was a significant lift in the quality of lambs offered in over all grades. There was limited restocking competition, mainly for the better end of the lambs, and they paid to $170. The market for lambs under 18 kgs to the trade was firm to dearer by $5. All the other categories were 10 to 15 stronger. Lambs to the trade averaging between $7.50 and $8.20. The best heavy lambs made to $251. There was a keen competition for sheep, and they were 5 to 10 dearer. Merino mutton to average around $6.50 to $731 a kilogram carcass weight. The best heavy crossbred ewes made to $240. At Hamilton, this is Chris Agnew reporting for MLA.
Thanks, Chris. And finally today, the Horsham sheep with Graham Pimer.
Lamb numbers are up to 6,425 head this week at Horsham, operating in a similar market to last week. Medium trade weights on quality east a few dollars. Medium and heavy trade weight lambs sold from 188 to 218. Heavy lamb sold to 265. Merino lambs are few in number and sold to 183. Restockers and feeders paid from 123 to 177. The sheep numbers were similar at 1,174. Heavy merino ewes reached 195. Heavy crossbred ewes sold to 220. Heavy merino weather sold to 218. The light trade weight lambs, 18 to 22 kg, sold from 159 to 190 at average 840. The medium trade weight lambs, 22 to 24 kg, 3 and 4 score, sold from 188 to 205. The export weight lambs, 3 and 4 score, sold from 213 to 248 at 780 cents. Extra heavyweight lambs sold from 245 to 265. Medium weight sheep, 18 to 24 kg, sold from 120 to 169. Been Graham Pimer at Horsham from LA.
Thanks, Graham. We've got a little bit of time now to get through some of your texts, mostly on rainfall. Drew from Denali. He's had 21 millimetres of showers and scattered heavier rain for the week. Still hoping there's a bit more on the way. Greg Boyd at Mimondai, he says he's just up the road from Mum and Dad. My Mum and Dad, actually. That's just north of Bort, Mimondai is. 7.5 millimetres overnight. And Peter, close to Mildura, a little bit frustrated with some of the more generous figures, I suppose, from the Bureau. He only measured 4 millimetres. And there's also a text there referencing our dairy farmer who hasn't had power for 7 days, pretty frustrated that in 2021 that some people might not have access to phone or electricity. Also, just recapping the news from Acting Premier James Molino on some changes to restrictions around COVID. For regional Victoria, that means that public gatherings can increase to 50 people, 300 people in cafes and restaurants, 100 people at funerals, 50 at weddings, and you can have 5 people plus dependents in your home. Thanks for all your contributions today. Don't forget a couple of things. The website, abc.net.au/rural. You can also head to Facebook and search for ABC Rural or listen to the podcast.